The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. It's time now to return to the November 2019 edition of Our State. The issue this month is called The Smokies, and fittingly, the first article we're going to read today is entitled Season of Smoke. They made the page nice and black and put the letters up there in white for Season of and gray for Smoke. Very fitting. And there's a picture of a man holding a stick into a fire pit, which is quite smoky. At the first sign of frost, there's a whiff of comfort and coziness in the air. The smell of wood stoves and warm hearths, campfires and barbecue pits. In North Carolina, smoke imbues everything from our pulled pork to our mountain lore to our tobacco legacy, with complexity and deep memories. After all, where there's smoke, there's sure to be a gathering of family and friends hungry for stories and a taste of home. First article, The Science of the Smokies. That soft blue haze, the namesake smoke of the Great Smoky Mountains, is a quirk of nature that was once severely threatened by man-made pollutants. Now the vistas are opening up again. There's a lovely picture here. We have green, the tops of green trees and a couple of evergreens sticking up above them in the front, and then it starts to get smoky as the terrain trails off downwards, and we see the ridges that are so common out there in that area. The further away you get, the smokier it gets. But when we get to the last peaks, which are higher than the in-between ones, the sky is a gorgeous orange color, fading upwards to a little bit of greenish yellow. Plants produce naturally occurring volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. Because the mountains of western North Carolina contain tens of millions of trees and other plants, these VOCs contribute to the signature blue haze. The mountains on my son's new middle school band T-shirt are all wrong. Pointy and jagged, sharp enough to draw blood. These unforgiving peaks belong in Colorado, not western North Carolina. Sketching the Smokies requires a more fluid hand. Over the past 300 million years, the Appalachian Mountains have been polished smooth by wind and water, and even on the clearest of days, a soft blue haze blurs the landscape. Our mountains are called the Great Smoky Range because of the dreamy haze of impalpable mist in which they are always wrapped. The writer and outdoorsman Horace Kephart wrote that in 1905. He was speculating. An act of the North Carolina legislature noted the Great Iron or Smoky Mountain in 1789, marking the earliest known use of that place name, and an 1804 map standardized the spelling to Smoky. The original spelling was S-M-O-A-K-Y. They removed the A. Those legislators and mapmakers got the name from somewhere, but we don't know who first used it or why. The mountains are often obscured by rain-charged clouds rising mist, drifting fog, and, my favorite, ragged scraps of cloud that snag on tall trees when the rest of the fog bank moves along. All of these atmospheric effects might be considered smoky, or the name might have been inspired by actual smoke, perhaps from fires set by the Cherokee to clear their fields. Kephart's theory, though, seems the most plausible. The Smoky Mountains are smoky in the same way that the Blue Ridge Mountains are blue. We gaze at the peaks through a subtle blue-gray filter, and Kephart captured its beauty better than anyone. The mountain haze lends a mirage-like effect of great distance to objects that are but a few miles off, he wrote in Our Southern Highlanders. The foreground of such a landscape in summer is warm, soft, dreamy, caressing, habitable. Beyond it are gentle and luring solitudes. That landscape proved so alluring to Kephart that he abandoned his wife and six children in St. Louis to live in the mountains in solitude. His writing helped galvanize the movement to preserve the Smokies as a national park, where millions more have enjoyed the same views he once did. Well, not exactly the same. Our views are much worse. Scientists can help us understand what's changed. If you've ever torn a leaf, there's all these little veins in it, and as soon as you tear it, tiny little drops appear, says William G. Wilson, a professor of biology at Duke University. Those drops contain volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. Though that term is familiar from warning labels on paint cans, not all VOCs are dangerous. The compounds are organic because they contain carbon, and volatile because they evaporate. The scent of balsam needles, VOCs. Plants produce these compounds to attract pollinators, repel pests, or protect against heat stress. They're part of the biochemical arms race known as natural selection. There are tens of thousands of these compounds, Wilson says, and in the Smokies there are tens of millions of trees, all releasing VOCs. Once in the atmosphere, VOCs react with other compounds to form particles, and those particles cause haze. You might say the trees cause pollution, though you wouldn't want to get carried away, as Ronald Reagan did back in 1980. Approximately 80% of our air pollution stems from hydrocarbons released by vegetation, he said. So let's not go overboard on setting and enforcing tough emission standards from man-made sources. Reagan's numbers were dodgy, but his statement contained a kernel, a tiny kernel of truth. Trees produce haze, but natural VOCs surely create the loveliest type of pollution, and on their own they pose few risks. Man-made pollutants are a different story. In the decades after the dedication of Great Smoky Mountains National Park in 1940, the region west of the park filled up with pollution-spewing vehicles, factories, and coal-burning power plants. Prevailing winds carried sulfates and other pollutants into the Smokies, threatening the health of plants, animals, and people, and also impeding the views. By 2004, the Smokies had some of the worst visibility in the U.S. The new haze wasn't a diaphanous blue scrim that softened the vistas, but an ugly gray curtain that blocked them. Natural haze, because these particles are smaller, will tend toward blue, says William Malm, a physicist at Colorado State University who recently led the National Park Service's efforts to monitor air quality. Haze from sulfites tends to be gray. Why is the sky blue? Because blue light has a short wavelength and therefore gets scattered by the tiny molecules of oxygen and nitrogen. Why is haze from natural VOCs blue? Because these small particles, like air molecules, scatter mostly blue light. Why is haze from coal pollutants gray? Because the larger sulfate particles scatter light from a broader range of wavelengths. If you see a blue haze, then typically you can see a long way, Mom says, but you can't see far through a heavy sulfite phase, and that's a problem for a national park. Great Smoky Mountain National Park maintains more than 800 miles of hiking trails, but most of the 11 million people who visit every year never stray far from a paved road. They come for the views of flame azaleas on Gregory Bald in the summer or dazzling blue birch in the fall. 100 years ago, if you were looking at something 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers away, flowers blooming or the leaves turning, the colors would have been much more vibrant, Mom says. Today you can't see as much, nor can you see the closer landscape features with the same clarity. The good news is that sulfate levels have dropped as power plants shift from coal to natural gas. Views have improved dramatically over the past decade, though they remain far from perfect. With the right timing, however, you might just enjoy a Smokies view as Kephart did. Perhaps the cleanest air we've ever seen at Great Smokies is when the hurricanes come through, Mom says. I mean, 100-mile-per-hour winds, the haze really gets dispersed. So the best time to go to the Great Smokies is right after a hurricane. He laughs and adds, that's tongue-in-cheek. Even so, Mom's joking recommendation meshes with the advice of Julian Davis, a British-born, Asheville-based artist who's been creating beautiful brooding oil paintings of the Southern Highlands for more than 2 decades. To sketch and paint, Davis heads into the mountains at dawn or just before sunset, always keeping an eye on the forecast. If you have a big vista, you have to know what the weather's doing, Davis says. You have to be in the right place at the right time to catch the more transitory effects, storms leaving or arriving, the effects of mist and fog. Together, the physicist and the painter offer a guide to capturing light in the Smokies. You can't pull into the Klingman's Dome parking lot at 3 p.m. on an August afternoon and expect to enjoy long vistas through a dreamy blue haze. Pick your moments. Rise early. Follow the storms. That's the writing of Mark Essig, who lives in Asheville. You are listening to our state magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments on the program, please call 919-832-5138. Next, we have the Pipes of Sparta. Speaking of haze, somebody's just blown out some smoke from this pipe that we see held in a hand on the right-hand page, and there's a lot of white smoke in the picture. While many North Carolina communities were manufacturing textiles or farming tobacco, a small town in Allegheny County became famous for its finely crafted pipes. Today, these works of art are largely collector's items, and generations of Dr. Graybow employees remain proud of their handiwork, written by Lee Ann Henyon. On the left-hand side, we have a lot of these collectible pipes there. Really beautifully created, regardless of what you think of smoking or pipes in general, each one of these is a work of art. Like the people who make or collect them, Dr. Graybow pipes come in all sizes and shapes, from linear models such as the Victory Straight on top to curvier ones like the Omega. Some are smooth, others textured. All are works of art. So the one on the top that they're showing here is a very smooth wood. I mean, I'm going to say it looks like rosewood. I don't know what it's made from, but has a lot of body to it. A very nice pattern. Not swirly, but straight line, but highly polished and beautiful. And then the next one down is actually hexagonal. And then the two below that have designs cut into their side. Rather simple designs. One's just geometric and the other's a little bit something like a leaf. And there are variations. One of those is a very dark wood. Other is a very smooth and a lighter colored wood, etc. The part you put in your mouth is all the same on all of them, except for perhaps a little curve to it. Has a little white Well, it looks like a spade, like in a deck of cards, but it's white. It's probably supposed to be a tree of some sort, an evergreen or something, but it's white, and it shows up very plainly against the black on the part of the pipe that goes into your mouth. I would call it the stem, but that's probably an incorrect term. In 1943, the world's largest pipe manufacturer moved from Chicago to Sparta, a small town near Stone Mountain, in search of roots. Mountain laurel roots, to be exact. Nearly every Sherlock Holmes-style smoking pipe you've ever seen was made from briarwood, a dense root that grows in the Mediterranean. But during World War II, shipments of briarwood pipes were stalled. The Linkman family, the owners of Dr. Grabo Pipes at the time, didn't know how they could keep going without the briarwood they needed. So they looked for an alternative. Mountain laurel, native to the hills of Appalachia, was the best replacement that Dr. Grabo could find. In an improbable move that would alter the lives of generations of North Carolinians, the company packed up its operation and headed east. Importing briarwood in the 1940s might have been difficult, but harvesting mountain laurel wasn't much easier. It required digging on steep hillsides in dense laurel hells. There was a lot of loss. Roots cracked and broke when they were pulled from the rocky ground. Because of this, as well as resumed peace overseas, Dr. Grabo made pipes out of mountain laurel for only a few years. Exactly how many, nobody knows. It's one of the questions that Rick Wooten, the company's present-day vice president and general manager, wishes that he'd asked his grandparents. Wooten's grandfather was among the company's first 10 employees in Sparta. The factory had hundreds in its heyday. If you grew up in Sparta, he says, you had a family member who worked at Dr. Grabo. It affected every family in Allegheny County at some point in their lineage. Four generations have moved through this building, and that's not counting the old location where a water tower bearing the company's name still stands as Sparta's most distinctive landmark. Three of Wooten's grandparents ended up working at Dr. Grabo, in addition to countless aunts, uncles, and cousins. It's an honor to run the company where my grandfather started as a laborer so many years ago, Wooten says. The current owner of Dr. Grabo Pipes, which now operates under the umbrella of International Pipes and Accessories, LLC, lives in New Zealand, but Wooten, a lifelong Sparta resident, oversees operation. He looks official in a red Dr. Grabo golf shirt, but he's got the casual demeanor of someone who doesn't mind having pipes of various shapes strewn among the important papers on his desk. Wooten leans back in his chair and says that from time to time, local visitors will walk into the plant's front office with bouquets of pipes they've inherited, wanting to learn more about them. People get nostalgic, remembering their family members sitting around smoking pipes, he says. The number of people who smoke pipes has been in decline since the 1960s, but a collector's market keeps things going, and many buyers have no interest in tobacco. Some people collect Beanie Babies, some people collect baseball cards, and some people collect Dr. Grabo pipes. These collectors want to know everything they can about the pipes, Wooten says. Without the history, an antique pipe is just a piece of wood somebody's been chewing on. Dr. Grabo doesn't give public tours of the factory anymore, but Wooten often finds reason to walk the floor where the 52-step production process can be traced from the imported briarwood to the finished product. Brian Johnson, a 25-year employee, is usually the first to touch each piece of pipe in the form of a dense, heavy, rectangular piece of briarwood. He sorts them according to size and then puts them back into the recycled burlap coffee bags in which they arrive from Greece or Spain. At that early stage, he decides if the wood can be used for a large or small pipe. There are dozens of possible shapes. Johnson has manned other stations in the building, too, including the finishing department where pipes go through the process that brings the briarwood's grain to the surface. The diversity of positions that he has held gives an appreciation for every job. Wooten calls the pipe-making process a marriage of handicraft and technology. If you look at the way these were made in the 1950s and now, there are a tremendous number of consistencies. Quality is determined by a human being. Every pipe we make is unique. If a human being crafted it, it's impossible for two to be the same. And that's part of the beauty. There's pictures here of the pipes in their raw form, if you will. It says Brian Johnson sorts the briarwood by size, tossing pieces into various baskets. Models used for production checks hang on a wall on the plant. So what I was saying is the unformed pieces, these are the ones that are the samples for making all sorts of various ones. And there are at least 25 of them just shown in this picture alone. So they have lots of different shapes. Johnson sheepishly admits that sometimes a pipe comes through the line that he can't bear to package and mail out. Those are the ones that he adds to his personal collection. When you see a special pipe, you have to lay claim, or somebody else will, he says. None of Dr. Grabow's employees regularly smoke, but almost everyone in the building has a collection of smoking pipes. There's just something about the way the burl of the wood comes through during the final lacquering that can drive a man to swoon. When the pieces of briarwood leave Johnson's station, they're wheeled on a clean, well-lit concrete path that's been worn to a sheen to a work area called the Briar Shop. Most of the woodworking machines in that area have been in operation since the 1950s, and the men who work them have perfected their use. Dwayne Love started working at Dr. Grabow in 1966. He retired 11 years ago, but in an act that's something of a pattern at the factory, it wasn't long before he asked to come back. My wife finds stuff for me to do if I'm home too much, he says. I can come in here and relax. It might seem strange to think of a factory floor work as relaxing, but to Love, woodworking is almost like meditation. Using an old piece of equipment that Dr. Grabow workers call a hand fraser, he traces a cast iron model to create a duplicate in briarwood. He holds up a sample and says, "It's been so many years I could run the whole pipe and never look at it." Wooten shakes his head in admiration. "I've tried working that machine before," he says, "and I felt like a monkey wrestling a football." Occasionally, workers in the briar shop find strange objects in the briarwood. They've discovered rocks and once even a bullet. It's not unlike how an oak tree will sometimes swell and swallow up a piece of barbed wire fence. "A root will grow around whatever it finds, and it'll hold on to it," Wooten says. Some collectors get nostalgic about their grandparents' smoking pipes, but around Sparta, more people get nostalgic about their elders making them. Officially, Judy Jones has been working at Dr. Grabow for 45 years, but she likes to say that she began reporting for duty at 7 years old. Jones can still remember the pride she felt as a child watching her grandmother work the sanders, perched on a stool, maybe the same stool that Jones occupies today as she double-checks the quality of what comes out of the briar shop. Under her watch, the job of sorting gets more specific. She tosses a discard into a box destined for a wood stove. Another lands in a collection that'll be made into pipes with carved bowls. Then there's a nice one that will work for a smooth-sided pipe. Each goes into its respective container. Plunk, plunk, plunk. Making pipes, it's a family love, I guess, since my father worked here too, Jones says, pausing to point out an imperfection that sends another potential pipe bowl to the wood pile. I like working with wood, the grain of it, how it lets you use your hands. It gives you a meaningful feeling to know you had a part in making something. Whenever I see a pipe in a movie or on television, I look close and think, maybe that's one of ours. Wooten sometimes jokes that with just 30 years under his belt, he's a newcomer to the business. But after hearing Jones's stories about coming to work with her grandmother, Wooten reconsiders and says, "You know, I never did think about it much, but I guess I've been coming here since I was around 7, too. His childhood memories include the witty whirl of the Sanders and the hush of the place where his grandfather, a night watchman, would walk the grounds after hours. "He used to take me on rounds," Wilton remembers, pausing for a moment, recalling the times he spent by his grandfather's side, circling the old Dr. Graybull building to make sure nothing irregular was going on beneath the smooth, dark surface of those long-ago nights. Although Wooten doesn't own Dr. Graybull, the plant gives him a sense of belonging, as it does so many of the 30-odd employees who continue the work of their parents and grandparents. "These pipes," he says, "are the roots of our heritage." Leanne Henyon is the author of Phenomenal, A Hesitant Adventurer's Search for a Wonder in the Natural World, and she lives in Boone. It does make me wonder, though, who was Dr. Graybull? Or was it just a name that somebody made up? I guess I won't know. Well, let's pop back to the beginning of the magazine and read a little something here. And we'll see how much we can get through. Just a short article's up in the front. This one's entitled "Waste Not, Stony Point, Part of the Farm Tour." A century farm in Alexander County capitalized on an underappreciated and often overlooked product already sitting in the cow pastures. Why Joseph Allen Smith was nicknamed Daddy Pete is a question that even his great-grandson Allen Smith doesn't know the answer to. But the name stuck to the 102-acre farm that Joseph bought in 1907 to raise beef cattle, and today the historic century farm outside of Statesville is known as Daddy Pete Farms. Second-generation Sledge Smith began raising turkeys, and third-generation Gar Smith maintained the farm as well. In 1972, fourth-generation Alan Smith created a dairy farm on the property. Today, 700 Holstein cows occupy nearly 500 acres, and Alan's son Joe, the fifth Daddy Pete generation, lives a stone's throw from the milking barn in his great-grandfather's original clapboard farmhouse. A distinctive familiar tang scents the air on Daddy Pete Farms. That's because no matter what else happens, weather, prices, taxes, tariffs, deals, one product on any livestock farm is a constant: manure. In the late 80s, Alan began exploring cow manure compost. Scientists and colleges came calling to see what he was doing with his cows in his triangular 4-foot-high windows of compost, carefully tented and turned inside former chicken houses. "We were composting before it was cool," he says. By the 91, shipped their first package of Daddy Pete's Plant Pleaser. Today, the farm produces 22 kinds of certified organic manure compost. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine, and I certainly hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll join us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions? Call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.